From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Fairfax, California.
Glen Park.
Fillmore.
I'm from San Jose.
I'm from the Intermission.
UCCC World.
West Oakland.
East Oakland.
Coming up, the latest in the struggle over affordable housing in San Francisco.
If you stop building altogether or you slow it down so much, you aren't going to get the affordable housing or the affordable housing fees that come with that new development. So, you know, you're going to kill the goose that's laying the golden egg.
Then we'll meet the women who want to break through the stereotype of the surfer girl.
Like they're bikini clad jumping off of waterfalls, listening to, you know, like cool girly music.
And we'll talk to Oakland's own Fantastic Negrito about his singular sound.
People call me the punk rock Al Green. That is hilarious.
Get ready for Punk Rock Public Radio. One of the ways cities create affordable housing is by forcing private developers to build a little every time they develop property. In San Francisco, all new big residential buildings are required to include some units that are rented or sold at below market rate. That's 12 to 20% of the units is the rule. But next week, that could change. San Francisco's Prop C would give the Board of Supervisors control over how much affordable housing we require developers to build. And it would hike up that requirement to 25% affordable, at least temporarily. But opponents say the extra cost will make it so hard for developers to build, we'll actually wind up with less affordable housing in the end. KALW's Liza Veal has more.
San Franciscans know that housing is an issue that gets personal real quick, especially for Oz Erickson and Aaron Peskin, two main players in the face-off over Prop C. First, let's meet Oz Erickson. He runs the Emerald Fund, a real estate development company. And yes, he has round little Wizard of Oz glasses.
I would say that right now, we probably have done more projects in the city than anyone else, more units.
But he says building housing isn't free. Developers are already required to turn some 12% of their units into affordable housing. And Erickson says he can't go up any further. He wouldn't be able to cover the cost of building, even if he wanted to.
It sounds wonderful. And if the housing were free, it would be wonderful.
Aaron Peskin, who proposed Prop C, he doesn't buy that. Peskin is a longtime San Francisco politician who returned to the Board of Supervisors last November on a groundswell of concern about affordability in the city. Here's what he thinks about a lot of Oz Erickson's arguments.
It's hard for me to take seriously an individual who just bought a $6 million house.
The two actually live just a few doors down from each other. But never mind comparative home values. Here's exactly how Peskin's Prop C works. Right now, the affordable housing requirement is set in the charter, like the city's constitution. It says developers have to build this percentage on-site or this percentage off-site to this and that income level. And Prop C would take the rule out of the charter and put it in the hands of the Board of Supervisors so that it can be more flexible.
Board of Supervisors is committed to adjusting the percentages to make sure that we get the maximum economically feasible amount of affordable housing.
So the amount of affordable housing can go up when the market is heating up, down when the market is strapped. Erickson, the developer, actually supports this part of the proposal, the flexibility. But that's not all there is to Prop C. It will immediately hike up the number, in some cases as high as 25%, higher than any other city in the country.
It is unclear whether that number is the right number, and if the numbers need to be adjusted, we will adjust them accordingly.
Picking the exact number, that's something the city's chief economist is working on. Peskin and the other supervisors have promised that if the chief economist determines 25% is too high, then they'll bring it down, because Peskin says they do not want to scare away construction. But at the core, Peskin thinks that this is about taking back political control from developers.
The fact of the matter is, a handful of developers are fighting this because they'd like to make more money. And I understand that. We just have a disagreement.
Erickson, the developer, denies that it all just comes down to greed. He helped design the 12% requirement back in 2002. But he says the whole strategy backfires if we make the number so high that building becomes impossible, which is what he's predicting. Construction will freeze. Because as a developer, he says, the income from rent won't be able to cover the cost of building the units.
If you are providing a significant portion of that of those units for free, you can't. The other units don't support it. You can't build it, and yet it's tremendously attractive. It would be wonderful if you could.
But when developers say construction will freeze, how do we know they're not just bluffing to avoid the requirement hikes?
I don't think it's that they're necessarily bluffing.
Carol Galante is the faculty director at the Turner Center for Housing Innovation at UC Berkeley, and she spent most of her career as an affordable housing developer, so she says she knows the business side.
I think it's very difficult to figure out where the tipping point is, and I think that's one of the struggles that everybody is having. Some developments are going to struggle under these new requirements, and others may not, and that's the challenge.
If it seems crazy that developers are struggling to make a profit while real estate prices are so high, Galante says we should remember two things. First,
as rents are rising, costs to develop are also rising.
The price of land and labor caught up to real estate. Construction costs have actually doubled in the last 5 years. So higher rent doesn't necessarily mean more profit. And the second thing, most of the money that projects make once tenants start paying rent, it doesn't go to the developer. Most of it goes to investors. So before building, developers want to be sure that they can cover those costs and make a profit.
And if they believe that they'll have enough rent to do that and make a reasonable profit, then they'll do it. If they feel that they can't, then they won't.
Galante says if the affordable housing requirement is raised to 25%, the projects that are most likely to break ground will be the super high-rent luxury ones. The relatively moderate ones, those are the ones at risk of not getting built. So Galante says,
you'll end up with kind of a barbell effect of having housing for, you know, very low income and housing for very wealthy and nothing in the middle.
So Galante says she's less worried about the political battle with developers and more worried about what happens if they can't build.
The risk of not building is twofold. One, you aren't ever going to bring overall prices down for the large majority of people.
This is the supply and demand argument that says the less we build, the worse the shortage gets.
And then the second problem is if you stop building altogether or you slow it down so much, you aren't going to get the affordable housing or the affordable housing fees that come with that new development. So, you know, you're going to kill the goose that's laying the golden egg.
In this system, San Francisco depends on developers for a lot of its affordable housing. The public interest is yoked to the business interests. Whether that's a good or bad thing is a question bigger than Prop C. Prop C is about the number, 25%. And if it passes, expect a lot more haggling over that number. It's a fight that's not going away. For Cross Currents, I'm Liza Veal.
You'll have your chance to vote this coming Tuesday. Or maybe you're like me and you've got a mail-in ballot. Check out our website for more election stories to help you with all your big decisions. We're KALW.org. And tune in next Tuesday, June 7th, to hear the results come in right here at KALW. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Ben Trefney, in for Hannah Baba. Our idea of what it means to be a surfer is pretty different from our idea of a surfer girl.
Like they're bikini clad jumping off of waterfalls, listening to, you know, like cool girly music.
That's De La Soul, director of a new surf film featuring many of the women who surf San Francisco's Ocean Beach. The movie she made is called It Ain't Pretty.
I just wanted something a little more edgy, you know, something more the reality of who we are here at Ocean Beach.
The surfing world has been slow to recognize women as serious contenders. The International Mavericks Big Wave Surfing Competition that convened earlier this year in Half Moon Bay featured 24 surfers and not one woman. Some say it's hard for talented women to get pro sponsorship unless they also look like fashion models. So De La Soul's film isn't about bikini babes. It's about real California women who are passionate about surfing. Let's hear what a few of those women had to say.
My name's Beth Price Jeffress. I am just 44, and I've been surfing Ocean Beach probably for 10, 12 years now.
My name's Bianca Valenti. I'm 28. I've been surfing for 21 years.
My name's Camila Fernandez. I've been surfing for about a year and a half.
My name is De La Soul, and I've been surfing my whole life since I was about 5.
My dad always said, you can do whatever guys do, if not better. So I've had confidence that way. But you have to extra prove yourself out there.
I mean, I remember going out with you too. We'd go out to Dead Man's and we'd get heckled, and after a while we just kept going and going and going. But we'd always sit at the drug.
Every now and again, you know, I'll get cut off, and I make up in my mind it's because I'm a woman. It may not be, but I've had those situations where men, until they can see that I surf, I kind of have to prove myself. Once I prove myself up in the lineup, they're more likely to give up a wave that I'm, you know, on.
You run into certain situations where maybe you feel like you're outnumbered because you are, but then there's also a lot of situations where being outnumbered is an advantage.
Here, you're more likely to get called into a wave than pushed off of a wave.
It would take a pretty unique individual to start a fight with a woman, but you will see fights amongst the men, so that's advantageous. And you know, I just find that a smile goes a long way, so I try to keep it friendly.
I feel like when you do gain respect from them, you gain ultimate respect. Like, wow, that's a girl that's able to do that. I mean, you go travel around the world and surf, and I might not be surfing pretty, but you know, guys are, it's big days out, and they wonder where, you know, where do you surf? Where are you from? And you'll tell them, and now they're like, oh, wow. And you kind of get a little kudos for surfing Ocean Beach.
And Susie paddled over to me and was like, dude, where'd you get that wetsuit?
They have women-specific gear now, finally. I mean, we would be surfing literally in men's wetsuits that were kind of dragging down in your legs. They were ill-fitted.
Balloon up with water.
Yeah. No butt. And there's more.
I think equipment is a really important one for the women, and that our equipment is going to be different from the men's because we don't have as strong of upper bodies. And so, and like...
Well, I think in general, in the last 10 to 15 years, surfing has progressed immensely and gotten popular, where it's like tripled in population of how many surfers. So that has made a big difference. And I have seen a lot more women having surfed out here. But again, until I started this project, I didn't know any of them.
Well, I guess I never consider us as a group of women that surf. We just contact each other. You know, we all will text each other right before we go out. I always surf better when I'm with them, actually. They make me just feel calmer, and yeah, I'm very happy to be surfing with another woman.
You know, we all kind of like a little bit want to be the only woman out there ripping, but when we are together, there is kind of a cheerleading squad of, you know, and supporting each other as we take off.
That piece was produced by Martina Castro, and it's just a few of the women in and behind the surf documentary It Ain't Pretty, about female surfers who charge at Ocean Beach. The film kicks off the 15th annual SF Doc Fest tomorrow. That's at the Roxy Theater at 8 p.m. More info at our website, kalw.org. And while you're there, check out the video for this Mara Manicam song, all about surfing San Francisco.
This lady is a tough one. Getting you my bus one. It could be a rough one, or it could be the best one that you ever tasted. Wasted on your blue mind. Carving out the faces, racing on the high line. Good days, bad days, best I ever had days. It ain't pretty, but I'm going out anyway. Surf crazy in the city by the bay. Balboa, Noriega, all the way to Vicente.
It ain't pretty, but it's my city, yo. From the sunset to the Presidio. Good days.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Ben Trefney, in for Hana Baba. Now we're going to meet the Oakland-based musician who goes by Fantastic Negrito. It's a stage name that might throw you off step a little bit, but he says that just like the sound of his music, the name Fantastic Negrito is rooted in blackness, and it's also international. It's exuberant, but there's a sharp point to it.
Life, it goes fast, youth is gone. Feelings of loss, come on, grieve, move on.
Xavier DeFrepeles is the man behind the name and behind the music. He grew up one of 14 children, son of an Orthodox Muslim father and a converted Southern Baptist mother. He left home when he was 12, eventually settling with his street family in Oakland. And that's where he still lives today. Nowadays, Fantastic Negrito's busy touring the world, carrying forward the torch of Black roots music. His new album, Last Days of Oakland, comes out this week. In this episode of Bay Area Beats, he talks about the personal roots of his sound.
Inside of me, there's an elderly, conservative Muslim man. Inside of me, there's a Southern Baptist preacher. I mean, I feel it. You have to. They're part of who you are. The Black roots music, really, I remember an uncle of mine named Horace Brown. My grandmother, you know, this is the deep southern part of Virginia. It feels like Alabama. I mean, there's outhouses. There aren't any neighbors. And I remember spending summers there. And, you know, my grandmother's like, that's just Horace. Well, why is he called Horace? That's just Horace Brown. And I would sit on that porch with him and, my God, it was like going to a university. I mean, the stories that this man would tell about music and corruption. And as he called country music, he didn't call it blues. He said, that's country music, boy. And he would call me Amos, and that was my name. And I better answer to Amos. And he had one arm that he told me he'd lost in a sawmill accident. And he used to send me to that country store to buy Johnny Walker Red, and he'd mix it with grape juice. And that's what he did. We'd sit there and we'd talk. So I really channel him. I think he was an amazing genius in a sense. And a lot of people from that era weren't given the platform because of the history of the South. And we're talking, man, he was in his 90s in the 80s. So yeah, old Horace Brown lives inside of me too. With drinking, fighting, cussing, one arm. Genius. Yeah. Well, that night it turned to day. Oh, that night it turned to day. Night it turned to day. The number of the night it turned to day. Night it turned to day, oh, night it turned to day. I'd heard this music growing up and didn't think much of it. Night it turned to day, oh, mama, the night it turned to day. I thought it didn't have drums and everyone sounded miserable. I was walking in the darkness. I had not yet seen the light. I was sleeping with all the baddest, baddest, baddest ones. Lord, I thought I won the fight. But I think after I'd lived a life and failed a few times and got knocked down, something about the music, the authenticity of it resonated with me. Broken, battered, bruised, and scarred, I kept on singing. Night it turned to day. Oh, night it turned to day. Night it turned to day. Lord, mama, the night it turned to day. Night it turned to day. The night it turned to day. These are people like Skip James and Charlie Patton and, of course, Robert Johnson, maybe the king. Howlin' Wolf, you know, this Lead Belly, and as Robert Plant just told me in England a couple weeks ago, Blind Willie Johnson, whom I pretended to know who that was. I'm not going back to a work plantation that captured all the dreams and the happiness.
Give me light in the sunshine, baby.
It was coming from a very dark place, but something amazing came out of that darkness.
Feels so good. Singing naughty turned to day. Oh, that naughty turned to day.
There you go. I thought Horace Brown maybe would like that. I could see us sitting on that front porch together and him drinking his Johnny Walker Red and grape juice.
That piece was produced by KALW's Julie Kane. You can hear Fantastic Negrito play songs from his new album, Last Days of Oakland, at a free record release party on June 3rd as part of First Fridays. For more info, head to KALW.org. While you're there, go to our Hey Area box and ask us a question. Anything you've been wondering about this region we call home. We'll send out our reporters and bring you the truth. That's at KALW.org. Our team includes Hannah Baba, Luisa Cardosa, Lila Day, Nina Gensler-Debs, Chris Hoff, Angela Johnston, Casey Miner, Ted Muldoon, Stephen Short, Audrey Dilling, and Eli Wirtschafter. Today's show was engineered by James Rollins. Line producer was Liza Veal. Our managing editor is Jen Sheehan. Our managing producer is Julie Kane. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet.
Trying to get away, trying to break free from this 21st century slave ship drama. Whoa, whoa, why?
You wish you had more klezmer music in your life, don't you? Orchestra Euphonus, whom you're hearing now, plays klezmer and Eastern European folk music from Romania, Greece, Serbia, all around that part of the world. They'll be at Doc's Lab in San Francisco this Friday. Music starts at 9 p.m. For Cross Currents, I'm Ben Trefney.